We think women need to talk more openly about money because money really matters. It shouldn't be embarrassing or confusing. Join the conversation. We'll be discussing a whole range of topics which will help you get comfortable with your finances. Money Matters, brought to you by AJ Bell.
Hello and welcome to another Money Matters episode. I'm Laura Suter and with me is Danny Hewson.
Hi Laura, hi everyone. Welcome if you are a new listener. Now this podcast aims to help women feel more confident about their finances and our guest this week is quite simply an inspiration. Now Laura, do you remember the film The Holiday?
I do. It's one of my must-watch each Christmases, even though it's pretty ridiculous plotline, but I think that's what makes a good Christmas film.
Yeah, I must admit, Christmas Eve for me, that is the day, gin and tonic and The Holiday. And I absolutely love it. Can't believe it is over 15 years old now. I mean, just incredible. But I watched the film and I thought, hey, great film. What lovely houses. As you say, a bit of a bonkers premise. But that was that for me. However, Debbie Wasko, who had already won a Young Enterprise Award when she was 15 years old for starting a business selling hair scrunchies, she thought, what a brilliant business idea. So she started the company Love Home Swap, which became the world's leading home swapping platform. She later sold it for a whopping $53 million. And then went on to become what is called an angel investor, a person or a group of people who give money to companies starting up in exchange for a stake in the company.
And we wanted to talk to her because she's been a huge champion of female-founded businesses. And in March, she was appointed as co-chair of the government's Invest in Women Task Force. So their remit is to create a £250 million pot to help women entrepreneurs build their businesses.
She had an incredible stat, and that is that it is at the moment just 2 pence of every £1 of equity funding here in the UK goes to female-founded businesses. And that's a number that's been fairly static for decades. So she's got a huge mountain to climb.
So definitely keep listening for that interview. But before we get to Debbie, we wanted to do our one thing. So this is where we talk through the thing that everyone's been talking about and break it down into a jargon-free way and kind of explain why everyone's talking about it. And this week it felt like it had to be mortgages. So all of the news websites have been full of speculation about when the Bank of England is likely to bring interest rates down. But at the same time, there's been some very eye-opening figures released about the number of homeowners who are now going to have a mortgage that they'll still be paying off when they reach retirement age.
Yeah, let's start with the Bank of England because we're recording this on Monday, and last week on the Thursday, we had the Bank of England making its May interest rate decision. And there had been at the start of the year lots of anticipation that by May, we might start to see the first interest rate cut. But no, that didn't happen. Instead, the Bank of England held the base rate at a 16-year high of 5.25%, 5.25%, the sixth time that they have held that base rate steady. But there was a huge amount of interest in this particular decision because whilst we have seen the voting sort of change over the past couple of months, this time the vote was 7-2 with two people voting to cut. So each member of the Monetary Policy Committee have an independent vote. They get to decide whether or not to put rates up, to hold them firm or to cut. And Andrew Bailey, who is the governor of the Bank of England, said that things are moving in the right direction. And although he was keen to point out that it is definitely not a fait accompli, his words, that there'll be a cut in June, in just a month's time, he also said that things are definitely moving in the right direction and definitely not been ruled out. Now, between then, now and then, there's quite a lot of data that the Bank of England is going to be looking at. So it's worth keeping an eye out because I'm sure the news websites, the newspapers, headlines be absolutely full of everything that relates. and inflation has to be the biggest one. Laura, you and I have been talking about the fact that we've had this cost of living crisis, inflation. I mean, it went over 11% at one point. It's now CPI, which is what we are talking about, Consumer Price Index, is at 3.2%. And the Bank of England's target is 2%. So we're edging closer. And the expectation is that we will reach that 2% mark in the not too distant future, which could then lead the bank to decide that it is time to cut interest rates. But they also look at wage growth. So we'll be keeping a really close eye on jobs figures. They'll be looking to see how tight the labour market is, which basically means how many vacancies there are available. And they'll also be looking as well at economic growth. And we know now that the UK is officially out of recession. It's been growing, and it's been growing at a faster click than a lot of people had thought, far more robust, which could actually be bad news in this scenario, because there's been a lot of talk of a Goldilocks scenario, Laura. And I think financial markets love to put these names on things, and basically is trying to find an economy that's not too hot, not too cold, that, you know, inflation doesn't go too high, but GDP, gross domestic product, so how fast an economy is growing, that doesn't slow too much. And if you can keep it all sort of ticking along, then that is considered a Goldilocks scenario. And potentially we could see a rate cut, as I say, in June, and potentially we could see three rate cuts by the end of the year, which would take the base rate to 4.5%. But remember, the base rate was under 1% between March 2009 and May 2022. So for lots of people who've only had mortgages for 10 years or so, this is a brand new world.
It definitely is. And I think lots of people by now will know the link between base rate and their mortgage rate. But for those that aren't, I'll just do a quick run through. Basically, mortgage rates are, through a very complicated and technical way that I will not go into because it's complicated and technical and also a little bit boring. Mortgage rates are based on effectively what the base rate is and the cost of borrowing in the kind of commercial markets, the cost that that banks can borrow at impacts the price that they're willing to offer you a mortgage rate at. So as we know by now, higher a base rate from the Bank of England equals higher mortgage rates. It has also equaled higher savings rates, so it's benefited some people. But it's those mortgage rates that are really feeling the pinch now. And what's interesting is that because it's priced on base rate, but it's also priced on kind of competition in the market, the amount of profit that banks want to make, lots of different factors as well, we've not seen mortgage rates move directly in line with base rate. So actually, in April, for example, we saw mortgage rates rise, even though nothing happened to the Bank of England's base rate. And so that just gives one example of how mortgage rates aren't directly moving with base rate. As we get closer to the Bank of England expecting to cut rates, then we would expect to see those mortgage rates drop. But what we saw at the start of the year in January was this really fierce competition among banks and building societies when it came to mortgage rates. We saw this big cut to mortgage rates, even though, again, nothing had happened to base rate. Now what we've seen is a bit of kind of unwinding of that, and mortgage rates have increased a bit. And so to give you an idea, data from Moneyfacts shows that the average two-year fixed rate mortgage is risen to 4.91%, and the average five-year fixed rate has risen to just under 5.5%. So Danny, like you say, for those people that are still sitting on their cheap mortgage rates, I am one of them, that is going to be an eye-watering increase when it comes to renewing the mortgage. Now, one thing to point out is those are average rates. If you've got a decent amount of loan to value, so if you've got a decent amount of deposit compared to how much you're borrowing, and you've got a good credit rating, for example, and you use a good broker who hunts around for a good deal, then it's highly likely that you'd be able to get a better rate than that. Those are very much the average. But it's, I think, helpful to give a kind of ballpark figure. The other thing that we really need to look out for is what's called jargon alert here, the standard variable rate. So this is the rate that you drop onto. So say you're on your fixed rate mortgage, you come to the end of that fixed rate mortgage, you haven't sorted out a new deal, then you drop on to the standard variable rate. Some lenders call it the revert to rate, which is even harder to understand. But this is essentially the highest rate that you'll get your mortgage on. And so it's the most expensive borrowing, essentially, that you could really have. So you want to avoid it at all costs. Now, what's happened as base rate has gone up is that that standard variable rate has gone up. So it's now averages around 8.2% across lenders. With some, it's even higher than that, obviously. And so you really want to avoid falling onto that, because that even a few months of that could have a really big impact on your finances. And so whilst it seems a bit scary out there at the moment, whilst mortgage rates are higher, while people might be concerned about how they can afford those mortgage rates, falling onto that standard variable rate will be very expensive and is quite undesirable. You could definitely get a cheaper rate out there if you refinanced your mortgage.
Yeah, I know lots of people have been really concerned about their fixed rates coming to an end. And one of the ways that people have been dealing with the increases in their mortgage payments, which for some people have been hundreds of pounds a month, one of the ways they've been dealing with it is to extend the term. So, you know, if you've got a mortgage which you're paying off over 25 years, you might decide that you're going to extend that to maybe 30 years or even 40 years. So it just means that you're paying for longer. So your monthly payments go down to a much more manageable level for some people. In fact, I've heard lots of people saying that they've managed to end up paying the same amount that they had on those ultra low rates because they'd extended the term. But got to have a huge alert here, because it does mean that they will be paying an awful lot more interest to have that privilege over that period of time. And so Steve Webb, who is the former Lib Dem pensions minister, has done a bit of digging. He put in a Freedom of Information request to the Bank of England to take a look on how many households are extending the term out to the point where they're still going to be paying their mortgage after they reach the state pension age. And he found that more than 1 million households took on a mortgage term that will be paid off after they go over that age in the past 3 years. And I don't think anyone would be surprised that under 30s have been particularly impacted. You know, you've got a lot of people trying to get on the housing ladder, and the only way that they can do that, with housing costs now so expensive compared to where they were, you know, over a decade ago when we were at similar sort of rates, then they are having to look at much longer terms. And the Bank of England's data shows that in the final 3 months of 2021, some 31% of new mortgages had an end date beyond the state pension age. But when you fast forward that 2 years, it was 42% had an end date during retirement. Now, that then, of course, has huge implications for your retirement, because you might be planning, you might be thinking about your pension. You know, you get a lot of these handy reckoners which say you're going to need this amount to live on to a certain level in retirement. So you're making plans, you're looking at the numbers, but you're not factoring in housing costs to that particular equation. And to suddenly find that on top of all the other things that you want to enjoy in retirement, you've also got to still be paying off a mortgage, can make a huge impact to your retirement planning. Now, you know, it may be that you make this switch now because things are pretty tight, and then in a couple of years when you refix, you can change the term back. But it is something that you need to really keep a close eye on, because this potentially is storing up a huge amount of trouble for a lot of people down the road.
Yeah, exactly. I think you've summed it up really well there, Danny, and that it can be a good short-term fix, but you just need to really be aware of how much extra it's going to cost you over the lifetime of your mortgage, because that will actually, you can plug the figures into mortgage calculators online, and that will probably be quite an eye-opening sum of money for people when they see it laid bare, how much extra that extending their mortgage by even 5 or 10 years will cost them overall. And then I think lots of people will be doing this as a short-term measure. But it's interesting when you speak to brokers, quite often they will say, yeah, people extend their term, or they, you know, first-time buyers have a long term with the plan that 2 or 5 years down the line when their mortgage comes up for renewal, they'll reduce the term. But actually, not everyone does, and quite a large number of people get used to borrowing at that level and so don't reduce that term. And so it's about having kind of a quite strict plan in place if you are seeing this as a short-term measure. I think the other thing to highlight is that if people are doing this as a short-term plan in the hope that we'll then return to the super cheap mortgage rates of the past, that is just very unlikely to happen. And it's certainly, you know, if you're taking out a 2-year fixed rate mortgage now, or you took one out earlier this year, by the end of that 2-year period, we are not going to be at, you know, base rate of 1% even. And so we're not going to be seeing those ultra low mortgage rates. And to be honest, most of the forecasts show that we're not really expecting to see that at all, to go back down to that level. Now, obviously, long-term economic and financial forecasts are incredibly hard to make. But if you're thinking, oh, I'll just extend my term for 2 years, and then in that 2 years' time, mortgage rates will have dropped back down to 2% and I'll be able to shorten that term again, that is a risky strategy that I think so far the forecast show is unlikely to pay off in that way. So it's about being quite disciplined with it. You've also got to think about the impact of paying that mortgage for longer. Is a big outgoing that you're going to have going out of your finances for a longer period, which is going to impact your ability to save for other things and predominantly retirement. So, you know, if previously you were going to be mortgage free at 55 and retire at 65, that means you would have had 10 years before retirement where you're not paying that mortgage off, and you can top up your pension, for example, or top up your savings so that you've got more money to live on in retirement, or potentially you could even retire earlier. So you've really got to think about the impact longer term. Now, for those people who simply can't afford the increase in mortgage rates other than extending their term, then obviously this is an option. But for those people going into it as kind of a default way to reduce their monthly payments without first thinking about, you know, where they could make cutbacks elsewhere, whether they could afford a higher mortgage, things like that, then it's definitely one to pause and think it through fully rather than making it as a kind of default move.
Yeah, I mean, the figure that the Bank of England was quoting in its last meeting was 3.75% by mid-2027. And I sort of latched onto that because I'm in the same position as you, Laura. I'm still on a fixed rate at this ultra low rate. And my fixed rate doesn't end until December 2025. So I've sort of been watching this, not
quite,
just through
quite smugly from the sidelines, I imagine.
quite smugly, but also with the same kind of terror that most people are feeling when they're thinking about the end of their fixed rates, because it is likely that we're still going to be in a scenario where we're talking about over 4% for the base rate. So it is something that I'm having to factor in even now. And it is all about making sure that you are aware, that you're planning. But sometimes it's just not easy because we do tend to spend what we have, don't we? I mean, I certainly do. I think about my household income and, every penny is accounted for.
Even if that's with a few extra beers down the pub, eh?
Well, yes, I think it's important to make sure that you budget those few extra beers in. Okay, let's move on to our brilliant guest. We gave her a bit of an introduction earlier, but Debbie Wasko's mission to help more female-founded businesses get funding really struck a chord with us here at Money Matters, because we often talk about the gender pay gap and the gender investment gap. But the gender funding gap is something that we've not really touched on and is massively important.
And that was laid bare by the Rose Review, which was carried out by Alison Rose, the former boss of NatWest. That review found that an extra £250 billion could be added to the UK economy if women matched men in receiving funding for new businesses. Some of the numbers are moving in the right direction, though. There's reason for positivity, because there's lots of brilliant women out there with brilliant ideas, but they are lacking the cash that they really need to get their business off the ground. So in March, the government's Invest in Women Task Force was created with the aim of amassing £250 million pot of cash, which will go towards funding those female startups. And that followed a U-turn by the government to plans that would have increased income thresholds for potentially risky investments to high net worth individuals, something that would have significantly reduced the number of female angel investors. So here's what Debbie had to say.
For people that don't know you, Debbie, just talk us through your background, because you have been described as a serial entrepreneur, a serial successful entrepreneur. So let's talk about those businesses and how people might best know you.
Firstly, thank you for having me. So my background is that I have had a 25-year long entrepreneurial career. And I was 50 a few months ago and set up my first business when I was 25. And I've built and exited three businesses during that period of time. And I'm probably best known for a couple of them, one of which is Love Home Swap, inspired by the film The Holiday, which I grew and exited through a sale to Wyndham, the hotel group, and it became the biggest home exchange for holidays platform in the world. And then the last business, which I sold just over a year ago, was Albright, the members clubs and the digital platform for women's careers. So all of that looks very sort of rosy from the outside. And I have scaled businesses. I've raised capital from anyone who'll have me, from angels through to venture, through to private equity, both here and globally. But obviously underneath the surface, there's been a lot of war stories, moments where I didn't think it would work. And now I have a range of different business interests. I'm executive chair of a business called The Better Menopause, where Anna Jones, my Albright co-founder, and I are the lead investors. And that's a really important business developing science-driven supplements for perimenopausal and menopausal women. I'm on the board of Channel 4, and lots on top of that. And I'm also doing probably the most important role of my career, which is I'm the co-chair of the Investing Women Task Force, which is set out to solve the systemic problem of women not raising capital in the UK, nor indeed investing capital, by creating the biggest funding pot in the world to fund female entrepreneurs to make the UK the best place in the world to be a female founder. So it's never boring. It's sort of good, bad, and ugly in equal measure. But I think I am, if I'm a poster girl for anything, it's somebody who's done it, who's got the scars to prove it. And I think who demonstrates that you can do it, but it takes a village and you need the right people around you.
I want to talk more about the task force, because obviously that's one reason that we've got you on this podcast. But you mentioned war stories there. What was it like when you were getting started? Because as you say, you've got the scars.
I mean, I suppose two things. And there's nothing like writing a book. And my book, Believe, Build, Become, is a woman's guide to supercharging her career that Anna and I co-authored just before the pandemic. And writing a book makes you reflect on why you do the things that you do. And I think for me, some of it, and a lot of it for women, is about exposure and role models. So I grew up in a very entrepreneurial Jewish immigrant family in the north of England, where I didn't know anybody who had a conventional job. Everybody I knew was an entrepreneur. They would never have used that word because it sounds quite grand, but they were business owners, even when the businesses were humble. And in particular, the women in my family ran businesses and ran the family. So I always say that I'm the latest in a long line and a continuation of profoundly difficult women. And I'm proud of that. And my grandmother, who died at 97, ran a chain of sweet shops and off licenses in the north of England because her husband had died and she took on the businesses. And so my formative memories are of women working in my grandmother's case. And she was a notoriously awful driver, as am I, and never learned how to reverse her armored van that she used to, you know, drive around collecting the money and dropping it off at the bank. So it, for me, the world of work when I entered it after university was very surprising, because I thought that women ran the world because they ran my family. And when I entered my first job, and I've only been sort of gainfully employed by anyone other than myself for 4 years of my career after graduating until I was 25, I was very surprised to learn that women didn't run the world of work. And I had always had in my DNA that you have to see it to be it, and a real sense of sort of stubborn determination. So when I was 25, I didn't know anything about anything much. I was also young looking and pretty, and I learned very fast how to get really good at asking men for money. And that's been a big part of my career success, which, if you think about it, too hard is a bit weird, right? You know, if you're going to raise capital as a female entrepreneur, that capital comes from men, because only 2% of all capital allocated in the UK goes to back a female founder. And that's remained flat for as long as anyone can remember. On the other side of the table, at a senior pen holder level, 2% of partners in venture capital private equity are women, and a stat from a few weeks ago via Diversity VC shows that there are 23 women total in the UK who own any of the economics in any venture capital fund, right? It's just crap. So I suppose for me, throughout all of this, I'm so used to having been the only woman in the room that I sort of stopped noticing. But I firmly believe that great things happen when you meet amazing women who change your life. And my Albright business and that whole story over the 6 years that we did it was about a chance encounter with a woman, Anna Jones, who was the CEO of Hearst, is now the CEO of the Daily Telegraph, who's my partner in crime, if you like. And it was at an event that I nearly didn't go to. I'm one of those. So I think that we're stronger together. And that's a big reason to use my muscle and platform, and as much as I have one, and sort of tenacity and address book, to try and change something. You know, I've been very much brought up with the belief, if you can, you should, and stand for something, which I preach a lot to my children, much to their eye-rolling delight. And I think this is my mission. You know, it's what I have been about over the last 25 years. And as I enter my 50s, I think I've got a responsibility to try and change the ecosystem and the dynamic, and it's ripe for change.
I mean, what you said there, that figure, 2 pence of every £1 of equity funding in the UK goes to female-founded businesses. When I saw that, I wasn't surprised, and yet I was surprised at the same time, because I kind of thought that by now we would be in a different place, but things have remained very static. So you've now got involved in this government task force. It's hoping to do what it says on the tin, get more money for female founders. How did you get involved, and what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, I'm a politics nerd, really. And I've chaired a government review before in 2015, and they're funny things to do, but I did a pretty good job of that. So in that sense, I know how you can use something that's industry-backed to get government support. So some of it's sort of tactics. I sat on the board of Alison Rose's review into female entrepreneurship for 4 years, which did some good stuff, but primarily around mentoring and networking, all of which is important. But this issue of economics, which is my point, really, because I've been at the coalface for so long, and I'm a very prolific angel investor, and I only back female-led businesses. What women need is money. You know, mentoring and role model, that's all great, but we need backing, right? So when I was asked to take this on, and my co-chairs, Hannah Bernard, who runs Barclays Business Bank, we were very focused on setting a target, because that's what entrepreneurs do. That's why entrepreneurs are a really important part of pulling policy forwards, because we're determined and we're deadline focused, and we're sort of good at cajoling and the art of the possible, of this 250 million funding pot. So what does it mean? And just to get really clear on this, because I think it's possible for there to be some confusion. The essay question is this. Let's start from the investor side of the table. Women don't invest. We need more women-led venture capital funds with an investment mandate to back female-led businesses. So this funding pot that I'm dragging everybody towards will be to back more female VCs with a mandate to back female entrepreneurs. And I say that very clearly because what I've had since I announced this with the Prime Minister is a lot of incoming, more than I can possibly handle, many of which is from high quality female founders looking for funding. I'm not going to be able to fund them directly, right? But the ecosystem shift, the once in a generation shift, is to create more female check writers with a mandate to back women, right? So the objective of this funding pot to get technical is to create a fund of funds. The fund of funds mechanic will then back more female GPs as their name, general partners, venture capital funds, growth equity funds. Sitting adjacent to that, we're also looking at how we can encourage more women to angel invest. 2022 stat on female angel investors in the UK, 14%, last year 7%, right? So it's not surprising. The gender pay gap begets a gender savings gap, right? We just don't have as much money. So what can we do in this government-backed initiative to get British Business Bank to participate in backing more female venture capital funds alongside other investment banks, pension funds, and retail banks, which is the work Hannah and I are doing? And how can we encourage British Business Bank to ensure that when women are angel investing, their money is amplified through government commitments? The small end of things, we're also looking at grants and low level of debt funding, and that is important. But the big solve for me is how you get women funded to scale businesses, because by the way, albeit off a small sample size, women-led businesses deliver 35% better returns than male-led businesses. So for any investor, forgetting purpose for a second, it's just a great economic opportunity. But we really need to land that point through having an army of female investors in the UK, because I think two things happen in that case that creates genuine ecosystem. You get high quality female investors wanting to base themselves here, and you get high quality female entrepreneurs getting started or locating here. So I think I'm a proud Brit. I'm an immigrant and I'm a proud Brit. And I think this country is bloody brilliant in loads of ways that enable people who are new in this country to create jobs, wealth, and economic upside by virtue of being here. And so I am proudly British, and I want us to be better at this stuff because we're not good at it, right? We're like near the bottom of any league table. It's not cool. So I think that by chairing the Investing Women Task Force, which is industry-led but government-backed, And I'm very conscious as well that I've got political air cover for this, and there's a political clock ticking currently. Although I think this is a very sort of cross-party friendly opportunity. So I am focused on having an announceable that creates this fund of funds before the summer.
It's an incredible goal. And I think we speak to women about the gender pay gap, the gender wealth gap, the gender investing gap all the time. And there is becoming more of an awareness about it. And there is becoming more of an interest from women, particularly women of a certain generation. We've spoken a lot with Noon about queen ages who have pot of money that they are looking to do something with. So how can women get involved?
Women need to angel invest, and they need to be aware of the tax breaks that exist in the UK to encourage individuals to angel invest in high growth businesses, SEIS and EIS, and without giving you an accountancy class. But what's critical to know is that they exist to offset your risk, right? And many more men are aware of this than women. So when I raise money for my businesses over the years, and even for the Better Menopause as a good example, which speaks to a female audience, it's really hard to raise money from women because they're just less aware of the fact that if you're investing in a startup that has SEIS, Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme clearance, you get 50% of your investment back as a tax relief. If the business goes bust, you're 90% covered on your stake, right? So there's a massive education point. And also, you don't need to be Warren Buffett to invest, right? You can invest £1,000. So I think that's a big part of the thing that's my cri de coeur, if you like, which is female economic independence. You know, when I was 8, my grandmother told me that you always need to have some money in a secret bank account that your husband doesn't know about, which is the sort of profound thing to say to an 8-year-old girl, and tells you a lot about my grandmother. But she's sort of right in the sense that my mantra is women need to get rich, they need to talk about money, and they need to deploy their money in backing other women. But you can angel invest in backing other women, in backing female-led businesses that excite you in a really tax-efficient way that is de-risked. And we need to educate women about that. Because if I look at my Albright business or any of my businesses, there were lots of male syndicates of like accountants and lawyers and investment bankers investing. There isn't a female equivalent. So, you know, we need to bang the drum. We need to educate ourselves. Women do great work together, right? That tends to be how we like to do things. So female investment syndicates are really important here. So if you're interested and you want to support and make money, because it's not, you know, as we used to say at Albright, it's not a charity, you know, female-led businesses are a great investment, then I think find angel syndicates who are either mixed or all female, if that appeals, near to you, and connect with them, because it's an exciting series of conversations to be part of, and it's a way to be part of a changing conversation around female economic empowerment.
I think a lot of people, when they hear the term angel investors, they assume that you have to be incredibly wealthy. And I know that there was an awful lot of news coverage at the start of the year about changes that the government was looking at making,
yeah,
which then they U-turned on, because yeah, that would have crimped even further the number of female angel investors.
Yeah, and I think that was a fortunate U-turn. It just wasn't very helpful, right? Because it's the wrong signalling. I think in my businesses, I go out of my way to have women in my cap table, which means I'll take smaller checks from them, or I'll take checks from a syndicate, which we've just done in Better Menopause. So I don't think there's a check size that's too small, and it's a way to educate yourself, build your network, and feel excited about being part of a generational moment where we want to change the conversation around female economic empowerment and around women making money and talking about money.
I mean, you've said you've obviously been inundated with people coming to you and saying, okay, support my business. You can't support everyone's business. But if there is a woman listening to this who's got a company, wants to scale up, what advice do you have for them?
I think really understand what it is you need and ask for it, and get yourself networked so that you can. You know, typically one of the reasons at that very early stage level that women don't raise capital is their networks are not as strong as men. That's why we co-founded Albright. Whereas I think it tends to be easier for men to raise that early stage angel investment. So I think get your pitch deck together, figure out what you need, and get yourself networked to ask for it. There are some great all-female syndicates out there, like the Witsend Syndicate or Alma Angels, Angel Academy. You know, they're all very, very receptive to women-led businesses that are raising capital. Albright, which I'm, you know, I sold the business, but we ran Female Founders Pitch Days every month and continue to do so, as far as I'm aware. So figure out where to land it, but really understand your economics, really understand what you need, and be prepared to ask for it.
You said with this particular task force that you're standing on the shoulders of giants. Do you feel confident that things are changing?
I feel confident that I'm going to deliver on what I've said I'm going to deliver, because that's how I roll. And if I can and will and drag everyone with me, that is unprecedented. You know, I need my head looking up, but it's killing me, but it's unprecedented. So when I talk about the biggest funding pot in the world, it's about female entrepreneurs, that's not easy. And I think the double act of Hannah and I is uniquely positioned to be able to make that happen. Bear in mind, we've been, you know, commissioners supported by the Prime Minister, the Secretary of State for Business, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So we've got about as much air cover as we need. We now need to make it happen. And we're really on track to do that. So I don't think anybody set out to solve a problem in this way before. And I'm not sure that they would have done, because it's a peculiar combination of having been at the coalface of raising money for so long, with a big enough address book and probably profile to shout about it, and the ability to have that government support, which is cross-party, to try and make this happen. So I'm confident that we will make it happen, because otherwise I wouldn't have set out to do it. I would hope that we could do more, right? You know, because I think that what I'm also confident about is that these female investors are going to build great funds that deliver great returns, and great returns beget more capital. So I think it takes a moment like this because, as we said, that number has been flat for so long that I think business as usual just isn't going to change it.
Look, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Debbie Wasko there, who is co-chair of the government's Invest in Women Task Force and an angel investor. Now, there's plenty of information out there if you're interested in and have the capacity, obviously, to become an angel investor, or if you're looking for a entrepreneur looking for investment. But as with everything, make sure you do your own research and consider all of the risks before making any decisions. Now to my favourite bit of the podcast, Annie. Did Debbie have a financial confession for us?
She did have a financial confession, and she was incredibly well-spoken when she delivered it.
Well, my financial business confession, and I always talk about this, and I want people to understand this, because it is this point that everything looks glossy and perfect from the outside. But I think being clear on what a founder's journey is like, and my Love Home Swap business, which was this big glossy exit, you know, there was a day, probably 18 months into the business, where we had £1,000 in the bank account with payroll to pay, right? You know, and the reason I flagged that is it's really hard, this stuff. And cash flow is king. And you learn a lot on the way. And I think, and it's something I talk about in the book, that I use this sort of 3G mantra a lot, that the three things I look for and the three things I think you need a graft, grace, and grit. Graft, because it's just really hard work. Grace, because that's the thing I find the hardest and I've got better at, is grace under pressure, because you shouldn't burn a bridge and it's important to be gracious. Grace is the name of my daughter. But grit's the thing, right? It really is. And you aren't born with it. It's a muscle. And we all find ourselves in these really difficult situations. And the other quote that I hold very dear, because I'm a literature nerd, I'm on the board of the Women's Prize for Fiction. Again, why? Because women authors undersell men authors 10x, just so we're aware. So there's a real economic point there around writing. But then Hilary Mantel bought Wolf Hall, she's the great female author of the last 50 years, probably. And Thomas Cromwell's my favorite historical character. And in it, she has she puts words into his mouth where he says, the things you think are disasters in your life are not disasters, really. Almost anything can be turned around. Out of every ditch a path, if only you can see it. And I use that one all the time, often about money. So I think that, you know, entrepreneurs are unrelentlessly positive. You know, the joke about me is always the glass isn't half full, it's sort of on the table, you know. But I think that out of every ditch a path, when it comes to those financial tight spots, is the thing that gets you through.
I think a lot of startup businesses, when they're early on, will have struggled with that kind of even just cash flow thing, or getting something off the ground, the costs involved in it. I think I'm in awe of people that start their own businesses and take on the kind of risk and responsibility and stress of that. It is not for me, but I think it's great that there are people out there that are doing it.
And I think what she said was really important, because people, particularly entrepreneurs starting out, might look at Debbie and think, oh, success story. She's just brilliant. She must just have never put a foot wrong. And she's saying, look, this is hard. You know, sometimes it gets incredibly tight. And those glossy images that you see on social media, they might not be telling you the whole story. So, you know, have confidence. Don't lose faith. That is all we have for this episode of the podcast. We wanted to flag that we have a couple of brilliant guests coming up over the next few episodes, including the wonderful Arlene Phillips. You might know her best from Strictly Come Dancing in her judging days, but she was a real trailblazer in choreography circles and a massively successful businesswoman. do sign up to our newsletter via our website, ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk, so you don't miss out on any of our great content. And you can subscribe to the pod wherever you are currently listening, and that'll be coming out in a few weeks' time.
Has another special guest, a globally recognised figure who's working to get more women into leadership roles. So we'll let you know more about that on our social media channels in the next week or so. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook and X at AJ Bell Money Matters. But for now, thank you so much for your company. Do flag up our Money Matters campaign to friends, family and everyone you know who you think might be interested. And if there are more topics that you want us to tackle, more jargon you want us to break down, financial things in the news that you want us to explain, then either message us on social media or email us at hello@ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.